This is They Create Worlds, episode 210, Accolade, part 2. One, two, three,
four. If anybody wants to find me, I'll be in the last place you would look. In a place where people used to be, a land that's called reality, you'll find me there.
Welcome to They Create Worlds. I'm Jeffrey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Alex.
Hello.
Some quick housekeeping to get out of the way first. No, don't fast forward yet. This is actually good.
It is?
It is. It really is. If you like DragonCon, and you like seeing Alex and I look silly in front of a panel at DragonCon...
Complete with props.
With props. And you're a patron, or want to become a patron... There's a nice happy video for you showing the entire DragonCon convention presentation for your viewing pleasure if you're a patron on Patreon.
That's right. If you haven't seen yet, we finally got around. We did record our presentation on the 7th guest last year at DragonCon. Couldn't just put the raw recording up because we wanted to pair it with the slideshow that we used, because otherwise you were really only getting half the story there. You know, we got busy. As people do. And by we, I mean Jeff, because I'm not touching this stuff. But Jeffrey has finally gotten that together and put that up. It was a fun presentation. It was very well received at the time. Lots of laughter, lots of engagement. So a nice little bonus there. As we do more of these conventions in the future, of course, we'll do our best to a little faster, now that we know what the process looks like, get those up as well. We will be coming back to DragonCon, for instance, this year, and doing a talk on the origins of Dungeons & Dragons video games and the spread of RPG mechanics into video games generally. So that should be a lot of fun. We do DragonCon because I go anyway. It's my happy place. And I like to kidnap people and make them come to my happy place with me because that's safe.
Save me. Save me.
They do have a video game track there, though, of course, they're a general fandom convention. We are hoping to expand perhaps to some of the retro conventions out there as well to do some panels at here or there, though nothing's been finalized there yet. More on that if and when it occurs. But it's good to get out of the house sometimes, they tell me. I don't know.
And the other thing is that I am working and have finally cracked a code with the help of another friend of mine, uploading the entire podcast back catalog to YouTube. So I have a nice little visualizer for it. It has a nice little thing with our logo and what episode it is and all glowy stuff. There's only some amount of them on there right now, but it'll slowly grow to the entire podcast back catalog. Somehow I'm told that people want to listen to this on YouTube for some reason.
Absolutely. Now, of course, these will be audio recordings. There's a visualizer to give it a little bit of visual interest, but we will never be doing video casts, full video casts, because I subject Jeff to enough torture doing audio edits, having to figure out cuts and wipes and whatnot on video to cover up all of the shenanigans we get up to. That would be the end of civilization as we know it, or at least to the podcast. Still audio there, but if YouTube is your preferred way to digest this kind of thing, we are getting the new episodes up on YouTube as we release them, and we are going to be working on that back catalog for the next few months. Once again, of course, by we, I do mean Jeffrey and friends.
If we end up doing the video thing, the only way that's happening is if I get to use the fancy AI thing that can actually jump between cameras based off of who's talking.
Indeed.
I have thought of this.
So yeah, the podcast is doing, like, things. Hooray.
That it is, but that is not the accolades that we are here to bestow upon people.
That's true.
It is really accolade part two that they are here for.
That's right. We are going to continue our look in a planned two-parter, for a change, on the history of the computer and video game company Accolade that was very active in the 1980s and 1990s. You may recall that we left our intrepid heroes really at a high point. While they were still a relatively small player in the industry and closely held, they were profitable, and they had managed to establish several franchises that looked like they were going to be very evergreen for them, like Test Drive, most importantly, but also Hardball, Jack Nicklaus Golf, etc. The company well set up now in the computer game space and looking for more avenues to expand. It was now time to turn attention to a market that they had to this point quite deliberately avoided. That, of course, was the console market, epitomized by the Nintendo Entertainment System and the recently arrived Sega Genesis.
But consoles are the way of the future, and the 8-bit, 16-bit transition wasn't a crash. So what could possibly go wrong?
Well, Jeffrey, it turns out just about everything. But before we actually examine the entrance into the console market, we have to discuss a little bit the fact that they had to this point, by which I mean 1990, had not been in the console market. We have to remember, of course, as we said in our last episode, that Accolade was born out of the financial troubles of Activision. It was born out of Alan Miller and Bob Whitehead's belief that Activision was too wedded to the old console market and was not able to pivot away from it fast enough, not just in terms of putting their games on computer platforms instead of on video game platforms, but also in terms of not evolving their product to be a more computer-first kind of product and kind of moving away from console-style games of the time. Obviously, these are going to be a couple of guys that are pretty hesitant on the whole console market thing because they founded their company on the idea that the console market had become a flaming dumpster fire. Their first CEO, Tom Frazina, first president, even though he was only video game adjacent, he was at Androbot and was working with Nolan Bushnell at the time that all of this was happening. So he was also very keenly aware of how that console market had crashed and burned. They weren't necessarily interested in getting in right away just because this company called Nintendo has come along and said that consoles are going to be great again. As we discussed, Tom Frazina left in 1987, and then in 1988, they brought in Alan Epstein to be the new CEO of the company. By this time, it was becoming fairly clear that this new console market was robust enough that it was probably going to stay around. It became something that everyone, by which I mean the CEO Epstein, as well as Miller and Whitehead, who, as we will recall, both wielded considerable influence as board members of the company, they were all kind of the idea that this is something they needed to explore. But they were still very unhappy about the level of control that the console companies had over the product that was put on their systems. This is not something that was unique to Accolade. Most of the computer game publishers in the United States, which were used to working on platforms where they had total control over what they were doing, most of them chafed at this idea of getting involved on the console systems, which is why, of course, none of them really did until it was unavoidable in the 90s. Accolade was coming at this from a slightly different direction from some of those companies, because, as we said last time, Alan Epstein had been the head of operations when Activision was starting up. He was the guy that was responsible for getting Activision's cartridge manufacturing operation going when they became the first third-party publisher on the Atari 2600. Because of this, he knew what that business looked like. He understood the cartridge business in a way that a lot of these computer game guys didn't necessarily. His experience from doing this with Activision back in the day, of course, the costs are higher than floppy disk media. ROM memory is expensive, cartridges are expensive, the manufacturing is expensive, but you're looking at it probably eating up about 25% of your revenue. So, you know, that's a decent chunk of your revenue, but you price these games pretty high, so that's not terrible. We have to remember that one of the many forms of control that Nintendo and Sega exerted over their third parties was that you did not manufacture your own cartridges. They wanted to maintain complete control over the cartridge manufacturing process to keep complete control over the quality and to reap more financial benefit as well. You actually negotiated with the console company how many units of a particular game that they were willing to manufacture for you. Then they would manufacture that product for you, and you had to buy your inventory from the console company. This is something that gets talked about, but I don't know that it's something that always necessarily gets highlighted when people talk about the control. You know, the control wasn't just it had to be a certain level of quality and you couldn't have this kind of content or that kind of content and you could only produce X number of games a year. I mean, that was all part of it too, but the financial burden, the real financial burden of this whole thing was that you had to buy your inventory from Nintendo/Sega.
Let's put this in sort of the abstract here. Let's say it reasonably cost $5 to produce in just materials, one cartridge.
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo is obviously going to mark that up before it hands it off to the video game publisher.
Mm-hmm.
You're buying it from Nintendo at $7.50. So that's $2.50 to Nintendo in pure profit.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to mark it up again before you hand it off to a distributor. So now it's $10. Then the distributor have to mark it up before it hands it off to the retailer. That's $15. And then the retailer's got to mark it up again before it hands it to the consumer. So that's $20.
Sure. And of course, we're doing it in abstracts. The numbers are actually much bigger in most of these cases. But we have to remember, too, that there is a certain price beyond which the market will not bear. Right. As you have more overhead, you can compensate for some of that increased overhead by increasing your cost of your goods when you sell it. There comes a point where the public won't accept more. I think about in the modern industry, it's taken a long time. You know, it's been $60 for a long time for a new console game. In this generation, we are starting to see some games retail at the $70 mark instead. And there's been some real grumbling amongst consumers about this. But, you know, that $70 price point is starting to become more and more standardized. These games have been $60 for several console generations now. When you take account inflation, which, you know, was particularly bad the last couple of years with the pandemic, but even before that, inflation is a thing. Inflation's always happening. Cost of game development has been going up a lot as the technology gets more sophisticated, but the prices have remained flat. The companies haven't been able to raise the prices because the public has a certain appetite for what they're willing to pay for a game. And so even raising the price to $70, games today are probably still not priced where they need to be to fully be profitable, which is why you see so much more games as service kind of stuff. You see so many more add-ons. You see so much more paid DLC, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as a way of getting around that.
To give you an example of this, I just looked it up. In 1990, $60 would be worth $143 today, roughly. Can you imagine paying $143 for a video game today?
Exactly.
I can't.
Exactly.
I'd be like, no.
Mm-hmm.
Not just no, but bleep, 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 no.
Exactly. So just to bring this analogy back full circle, by having to buy through Nintendo or Sega, Activision has higher costs. But they cannot raise the price and pass these costs on to the consumer because the consumer is still comfortable paying what the consumer is comfortable paying. According to Alan Epstein, when I interviewed him, and of course it's been 30 years, so the exact percentages might not be accurate, but they're good enough. And remember, Epstein's a guy who knew what the business looked like back when you manufactured your own cartridges. He told me that back in the day, you know, the cartridge costs, you know, when he was at Activision, probably about 25% of your total costs. Well, he says working with Nintendo or Sega, you were looking at that being 60% of your total costs, buying the cartridges, manufacturing the cartridges.
That leaves you a pretty small margin, 40%.
Exactly. And of course, there's other costs you have to take into account, like development costs and marketing costs. You know, we're just talking about one cost here.
Right, so that leaves 40% for everything else.
Obviously, console games in this period were still very profitable. I mean, Electronic Arts, Acclaim, Konami, Capcom, all of these companies did very well selling video games. You could make a lot of money on video games, but the principle of the thing, for someone like Alan Epstein, who knew what this looked like when you did it yourself instead of having to go through the console manufacturer, it was insulting, quite frankly, because he knew it didn't have to be this way. He knew it shouldn't be this way in his mind. Certainly Miller and Whitehead and everyone else agreed. I'm not putting this all on Epstein. I'm just saying I think the fact that he had such deep experience with the manufacturing side of this industry in a way kind of almost made it worse. Like, dude, what are you doing? Even as the console market was looking like it wasn't going to be a flash in the pan, the new console market, they stayed out of it. They did license Jack Nicklaus Golf to Konami. Konami had a very nice business going, taking titles off the hands of computer game companies that didn't want to make those games themselves. They did the same thing with Electronic Arts and Skate or Die. They were getting a little bit of their product into the console market on this low-risk, low-reward kind of licensing thing, but they were staying out of the market. It just got to the point where nobody could ignore it anymore. And if they were going to keep growing, if they were going to keep up with their competitors in the computer game space, like Electronic Arts, who was moving into the console space, they were going to have to move into the console space too. They decided that they had to be on the systems. And of course, as a lot of the other companies did, they basically decided to forget about the NES, just move on to the next generation at this point. You're already working with 16-bit computers, so that translates well into working with 16-bit consoles, and it's the newer generation. There's a chance to make your mark, to stand out as everyone's moving to this new system, etc. So they decide that they do have to publish on the Genesis. They also decide to create a new label to publish on the Genesis. This was the brainchild of the marketing guy, actually, by the name of Ralph Giuffre. Ralph Giuffre made the very strong case that, look, the audience on video game platforms is very different than the audience on computer platforms. Computer game players tend to trend a little older and a little more affluent because those computers are expensive. They tend to therefore enjoy more cerebral, more strategy games. The console market is pure action. It's marketed primarily at 6 to 12-year-olds. Yes, Sega's changing that to bring in the teenagers, but even when you bring in the teenagers, you're still looking at a younger audience that's focused on fast action. His argument was that the Accolade name didn't really have any cachet with that group, and it wasn't a name that was likely to excite that group. Everyone, you know, bought his argument, and so they actually come up with a new label, Ballistics, which they release their early Genesis games under. If you see a game that's by Ballistics, it's actually a game by Accolade. I mean, it's not even a separate company or something. It's just, it's a label they came up with to differentiate their fast-paced, youth-targeted console product from their more cerebral, more strategic, older-trending computer game product. So they decided they'd do it under a new name, but they also decided that they were not going to go through Sega to publish on the Genesis.
Doesn't that go against everything Sega says you can do?
Well, you know, yes, Sega doesn't really want you to do that, no. But there's not a lot they can do about it if you cleanly reverse engineer the system.
Good old clean reverse engineering.
Yes, exactly. Mike Lorenzen, who we talked about in the first episode, one of the first of the Accolade programmers who created the game Sci-5 Trading Company, who had been at Activision before that, led the effort to disassemble the Genesis and do a clean room engineering of the system, which they were able to successfully do. And they started work on their first products. The first game that they actually started work on was Ishido, the casual puzzle game that we talked about at the end of last episode. Of course, they were going to follow that up with other games as well. But then, as they were getting everything ready to go here at the end of 1990, Sega introduced a slight wrinkle into the proceedings.
A lawsuit?
No. Because they haven't done anything yet. They haven't publicly done anything yet. There's nothing that Sega can sue them for yet. Sega did a console revision to the Genesis 3. Just so that people don't get overly confused by all of this, this was an internal model number revision. They didn't launch something called the Genesis 3. Several years later, Majesco releases a product called the Genesis Model 3. That's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about an internal revision number. It's all the Genesis, but they periodically revise the hardware. usually for cost reduction purposes. But this time they did something else as well.
Just to jump in here real quick. So if you're having trouble visualizing this, think of the PlayStation 2 generation.
Mm-hmm.
You had a really big version. You had a PlayStation Slim. You had a few others in there. That's a revision where they're taking the same hardware. It will run the same software stuff, but they're using slightly different components to try to make it more efficient and more cost-effective to produce.
Yes, but in this case, there's no rebrand, there's no outward change, the casing isn't changing, the casing's not getting smaller. They're not giving it a new name like the PlayStation 2 Slim. It's entirely within the internal components. Genesis 3 was not only a cost reduction, because another thing that they were very worried about was the increasing piracy from Taiwan. East Asian knockoffs were nothing new. Taiwanese and Hong Kong companies have been knocking off video game systems as long as there have been video game systems. The real problem with all of this, and the reason that it was almost impossible to stop, is that Taiwan is not a signatory of the Berne Convention at this time, which means that it does not recognize international copyright. So you cannot sue them for copyright violation. However, Taiwan does recognize international trademark law. Sega came up with a very sneaky thing to try to make litigation against Taiwanese pirates possible, which they called the Trademark Security System, or TMSS. The TMSS worked very similarly to the NES lockout stuff in that it was a handshake, where when you put a cartridge in, the console looks for certain pieces of code within the ROM, and if it finds those pieces of code, it will allow the game to load, and if it doesn't find those pieces of code, it stops the whole process. However, they took it a step further. The trademark part of TMSS is that when that handshake was completed successfully, a screen would pop up with the Sega logo, which is a registered trademark. What they're saying is, okay, guys, you can reverse engineer our security system. You can make your games run on our system unauthorized. That's great. However, when you do that, our trademark is going to pop up every time your game loads, and that is a misappropriation of our trademark and is a violation of trademark law, and now we're going to sue you.
Interesting strategy.
Indeed. So any game that did not conform to this TMSS system would not run on newer model Genesises. So Accolade had successfully clean room reverse engineered the Genesis. They had the games in development. They were getting the games ready to go. First Ishido, and then they had another 5 ready to come after that. Ports of Hardball and Star Control. Console ports of 2 European games. 2 European action games, Turrican and Onslaught. And a new football game, Mike Ditka Ultimate Football. So they had these 6 Genesis games that were just about ready to go for 1991. And surprise, they weren't going to work on any Genesis systems that people bought from 1991 going forward. They would still work on the old ones. No Genesis were getting retrofitted, obviously, but they were not going to work on the new systems.
Is this very similar to what Nintendo did with the Game Boy, where the logo comes down from the bottom whenever you start the game and it does that thing?
Yeah, I don't know what the Game Boy security was like, so I don't know if that was a security measure or not on the Game Boy, but it probably was. It wouldn't surprise me if it was.
From what I've seen from different videos, there's a handshake that, just like what you said, between the cartridge and the console itself, where that entire thing coming down, where it goes Nintendo coming down, and you got the little bing thing, that's obviously Nintendo's logo, and it probably is.
Yep. My guess is that's the same kind of thing. I don't know the Game Boy security well enough to say 100%, but it probably is. Again, you know, this was all about getting around the piracy in countries like Taiwan, which did not enforce copyright, but did enforce trademarks. That's the entire reason for it. Accolade had to very quickly go back to the drawing board, and once again, Mike Lorenzen led this effort. What they did, and it was completely clean room engineering, is he bought 3 different authorized Sega cartridges, disassembled the code in these 3 games, looked for common blocks in the code, because obviously one thing that's going to be the same across every game is going to be the TMSS handshake stuff, because that doesn't vary. So looked for common blocks of code and then started poking at that code until he was fairly certain that he had the correct code that caused the handshake to go forward. Then he wrote a manual based on his findings. Then that manual was used by a completely separate team to create the new code that was necessary in order to shake hands with, not bypass, but shake hands with the TMSS system. And that's why it's called clean room engineering, is it's a big no-no for one person to do all of the work under the law. You can't both figure out how a system works and then use that knowledge to create something yourself. What you have to do is you have to have one team that figures everything out and a second team that takes that work and figures out how to actually do it. And that's how you inoculate yourself. That's why it's called clean room engineering, because the second group of guys, the so-called clean room, had nothing to do with the copyright violation. They did not violate any copyright in what they were doing. They just, you know, used this manual that fortuitously landed on their desk to do all the work. They got it done, and they got their games out. One of them still didn't work. Onslaught didn't work because the person who programmed Onslaught put the TMSS code in the wrong place. It's not just that you had to have the code present, it also had to be in the proper place for the handshake to occur. But the rest of the games worked. So they got ready to release those in late 1991. But now, Sega had an action against them. They sued them for both copyright infringement and trademark infringement because of that misuse of the Sega trademark, because that screen pops up thanks to the TMSS. So that suit began in October 1991, and Sega was able to secure a preliminary injunction blocking Accolade from selling its games. They've already put in all this development work, all of this marketing. They've presumably already done the manufacturing. They already have costs, and they can't sell them. That's a problem. Obviously, they go ahead right away and do an emergency appeal of the injunction to the appellate court. It's important to kind of get this right, because Sega v. Accolade gets misunderstood a lot when it's covered by the general public. And I honestly, because it's been too long, I honestly don't remember if we covered it right when we did our lawsuits episode like 5 million years ago or not. So for all I know, that includes us. I don't look back. Always looking forward. But we're definitely going to do it right this time. There was no ruling. There was no finding in the case. What happened is that Sega was able, very much like the Casey Munchkin case that Atari and Magnavox or North American Philips had back in the early 80s, there was no decision in the case before the appeal. What happened is that Sega asked for an injunction, and Accolade claimed that there would be irreparable harm if there was an injunction, because they'd lose their window to sell these games, because people are always just moving right along to the next big thing, so you have to sell your games while they're still fresh, or you're dead, and that they were likely to succeed on the merits of their case, and therefore the harm caused by the injunction was not warranted. The district court disagreed and said that Sega was, in fact, the ones that were likely to prevail in the case based on their understanding of copyright and trademark law, and so they refused Accolade's request to overturn the injunction. So they didn't rule that Accolade had violated copyright or trademark law. They just said, we think you're probably going to lose, so this injunction is valid. So that's what gets appealed to the appellate court, not a judgment in the case, but the granting of Sega's request for a preliminary injunction. Then the appellate court hears the case. They very quickly dispense with the copyright element of it, because this is well established. Use of the code for this kind of thing constitutes fair use, and since there was clean room engineering, the people that created the product weren't violating the copyright, and so they quickly said, no, the copyright law doesn't apply here. Now, the trademark law is more interesting, because you're not allowed to use another company's trademarks. You're not allowed to cause confusion in the marketplace, do anything that would mislead the public into thinking that your products were authorized by the holder of the mark. clearly releasing games that have the Sega logo come up, even though they had fine print on there saying, you know, not licensed by Sega and blah, blah, blah. Having the company's logo, trademark logo, come up at the front is clearly a sign that this is an authorized product. So it very much causes confusion in the marketplace, can cause people to believe that Accolade's product is in fact Sega product or product authorized by Sega. There is a defense against that. And that defense is called the functionality defense. Basically, what this defense says is that if there is no way to functionally accomplish something that would otherwise be considered legal without misappropriating the trademark, then you're allowed in some circumstances to do so. The argument here is that we're allowed to clean room reverse engineer their game. That's legal. They've laid a trap by putting their trademark in here to try to block something that's otherwise legal. Therefore, everything we're doing is completely legal other than the displaying of the trademark, and there is no way to do this legal thing, clean room reverse engineer and run these products, without triggering the trademark. Therefore, under the functionality defense, we should be allowed to do this, even though it is causing confusion in the marketplace. The court was somewhat sympathetic to this. For one thing, they said, as regards the trademark confusion thing, they basically said, Sega has made a choice to let this happen. Accolade is not deliberately using the Sega trademark. They are only using the Sega trademark because Sega basically forced them to. So the court basically said, Sega made the choice to take that risk that their trademark could be confused, and now they're going to have to live with it. Okay, thanks, bye. So they were pretty sympathetic to Accolade on this point and found that Sega was responsible for its own confusion, and since Sega created the confusion themselves, they don't have a cause of action under the Lanham Act, which is the act governing trademarks. The functionality element is interesting. Sega, in the trial, claimed that Accolade could not assert a functionality defense because it was possible to bypass the security system without displaying the trademark. They offered as evidence a couple of games that were modified by a Sega employee to run without displaying the logo at the beginning. However, out of concerns that other people could learn how they did it, they did not allow Accolade to examine what they did. They did not allow the court to examine what they did. So they basically just said, you can get around this totally. See, we did it here, and you just have to take our word for it that it's possible because we're not going to show you how we did it.
Take my word for it, honest.
Exactly. And the district court went for it. The appellate court was like, wait a minute, guys. We can't just take Sega's word for it. It may be that there is a way to do this that nullifies the functionality defense, but you have not proven that in court by just submitting these cartridges that you've allowed nobody to examine and claiming that you successfully bypassed the system. Yeah, we're not inclined to believe that without further finding of fact. Here's the thing that people tend to get wrong about Sega v. Accolade. They see all of that part of the decision and declare that Accolade won the case. Well, there's two problems with that. First of all, they didn't win the case because this wasn't about the case. This was only about, can that preliminary injunction happen? There's still a whole case that has to be tried after that. Just like in the Casey Munchkin case, no one was drawing any conclusions of fact or law. They were just saying, should this injunction be allowed or not? The other thing is, even though the court basically sided with Accolade on everything, saying that Sega was responsible for its own trademark confusion, Accolade could theoretically raise the functionality defense. Accolade was not violating copyright because they had a safe harbor under fair use. Even though they said all of those things that were good for Accolade,
they didn't provide injunctive relief. They dissolved the injunction, but they didn't provide relief. It's a bit of a legal technicality there, but it is actually, I think, probably important to what happened next.
So what exactly is an injunctive relief versus just dissolving it? You dissolve it, it's gone, you won.
Well, yes. In a sense, they won. They were returned to the status quo where everything was at before the district court had filed the injunction. However, the court didn't come right out and say that Accolade was entitled to injunctive relief because there was still this lingering issue of whether the functionality defense could be used, because Sega did present a witness who said that he found a way to make a game load while bypassing the security system and not making the logo appear. Now, the appellate court was not pleased that no evidence was entered into the record, so they didn't feel that Sega had done enough to disprove the functionality defense. But they did still believe that Sega could potentially present more evidence in court that would validate their position. So they wanted the district court to go back and look at this again, and therefore didn't strictly provide relief, which meant that Sega still had this one lifeline, and Sega still had this method that they could use to delay the case and potentially delay Accolade's ability to sell their games. Even though Accolade won in every realistic manner in terms of the merits of the law and the fact that the injunction went away, they didn't just outright win. And I think that's something that gets lost when people look at the resolution of this appellate case.
Kind of akin to an annulment versus a divorce.
Yeah, I suppose in a way that makes sense, because they did legally say, okay, this thing that happened is gone, but they didn't make any legal findings as to why this thing should be gone, really, in a way. So yeah, I can see that analogy.
I think it was the hope of the appellate court that then the district court would apply the principles here and not grant Sega a new injunction unless they were to completely prove that the functionality defense was not required. But this is still more delay, delay, delay. It still means that the longer this goes on, the more Accolade can't sell their games, because even though the injunction was dissolved, the court declined to affirmatively say no injunctions should issue against the company in this case. It is a bit of a legal technicality, but I think that that's a big part of why people get this a little wrong. They won almost everything they needed, but Sega was left this one lifeline that allowed them to keep delaying the resolution of this case, which was only bad for Accolade in terms of their financial situation. So they were eventually finally forced in 1993 to settle the case. Obviously, the terms of the settlement are sealed, so, you know, we don't know exactly what the settlement involves. We do know that Accolade became an official licensee at that point. We don't know exactly what or how, but we do know that they had to make some payment of restitution to Sega, and that that restitution would continue through the end of the decade. Probably past royalties or licensing fees or manufacturing fees or whatever. I don't know the details because we don't know the settlement details. They paid a very steep price for trying to go it alone. The company basically shut down development for months while all of this was going on. They found themselves in very bad financial straits by 1993 when this was all finally settled. Even though their revenues grew to $45 million that year, they suffered a loss of several hundred thousand dollars, and they were in very real danger of going under. This decision to try to go it alone in the Genesis market was absolutely disastrous.
You would think they would look at other people and go, you know, no one else is really doing this, and we're really hesitant about doing this whole console thing. Why not take the safer route anyway, even though it cost us more money, instead of this potentially disastrous other path?
Because it is a lot of money, and they don't have the same resources as a lot of these other companies do. Electronic Arts is a publicly traded company. Activision is a publicly traded company. Acclaim, by this point, they weren't when they started on the NES, but by the 90s, they're a publicly traded company. These companies have resources. They have big financial backing. Accolade doesn't even have venture funding. There are some problems at this time in their PC business and their computer game business as well. Their internal staff is not necessarily kept up on all of the latest and the greatest. They've been kind of flailing and trying to figure out new areas to try to break in. They decide to do graphical adventure games. They bring in Steve Cartwright, another former Activision alum who does some Leisure Suit Larry-like, more adult risque adventure games, Less Manly, Lost in L.A. They bring in former Infocom programmer Michael Berlin to do another adventure game called Altered Destiny. These games don't do particularly well for them. They also do another Star Control game, Star Control 2, which is considered an absolute classic. Basically, Paul Ritchie and Fred Ford, Toys for Bob, build on the combat of the first game, but instead of having this Archon-like strategy board as the other part of it, they decide to have this expansive open-world exploration game where you're having to explore the galaxy, find resources, and engage in dialogue tree conversations with other alien races to put together a coalition to defeat the Urquan. All of this, I should hasten to add, is inspired by Starflight. Greg Johnson, one of the creators of Starflight, is very good friends and actually comes on to help with Star Control 2. Star Control 2 is considered a stone-cold classic, and it did fairly well for them as well, but those kind of PC games are getting more expensive to make and aren't necessarily bringing in the same returns. Even a success like Star Control 2, which was a success, just to be clear. The adventure games are failures. Then on top of all of this, they are losing a lot of their internal development capacity, and they lose their biggest and most important external developer, Distinctive Software. Of course, at this time in 1991, Distinctive Software is bought out by Electronic Arts, becomes EA Canada. So obviously, they were going to lose them anyway at that point, unless they decided to come in with a counteroffer, which was probably never going to happen. They don't have the same resources as Electronic Arts. But they were starting to lose them even before that, because they had another scandal that went on in this time period as well with Distinctive. Because, of course, Distinctive had been very successful with the Test Drive series. Distinctive was an independent developer, so they weren't just working for Accolade, they were working for other publishers out there as well. One of the other deals that they got from another company was a deal to port OutRun to computer platforms. Of course, OutRun in some ways is similar to Test Drive. I mean, they're very different in other ways, but the same idea that you're in this fast car and you're driving around at maximum speed, just enjoying the thrill of driving the sports car. So they reused some of the Test Drive code in their OutRun port. As Alan Epstein said it to me, they understood that this was an independent developer and that some of what they did on one project might end up getting used in another project, but they could not countenance code from their biggest series being used in a game that was essentially a direct competitor to their biggest series. So Accolade sued Distinctive over this use of the code in OutRun, and that completely soured the relationship between these two companies. Their internal product development capability has been degraded. They've lost their biggest external development partner. They don't see a clear path forward in the PC space. As I said, Star Control 2 was successful, but they weren't necessarily sure how to parlay that into a Star Control 3. The Hardball series was still going very strong. That was their strongest asset. But everything else was starting to flounder. Since they didn't have the deep pockets of an Acclaim or an Electronic Arts, in addition to the effrontery of having to pay so much for their cartridges when they knew that there was a better way, I just think that they probably were afraid that it wasn't sustainable for them to have to bear those additional costs. I think they were a little desperate. I think they felt a little trapped. As a result of that, they ended up caught right in the middle of the trap. It was a very bad trap.
Thus, they lost lots and lots of money.
Their lawyers could not repel legal complications of that magnitude. Definitely a trap. Yeah, they're in a bad shape, and they've also undergone, during this period of time, more management turmoil as well. They actually burned through another CEO. First of all, Bob Whitehead in this period really steps back from the company. Now, he doesn't leave the board, He's still involved with the company, but he pulls back from day-to-day work and doing development at the company. In his own words, he felt that the company was becoming more and more focused on sequels, and he was much more interested in innovative new games and always looking for the next thing. And so he was kind of disillusioned by the development environment. And so he basically left the company, though he was still on the board. So he wasn't like completely leaving the company. Meanwhile, this kind of conversation of what development should look like in the future was really eroding the relationship between Alan Epstein and Alan Miller and Bob Whitehead. Epstein was very much of the opinion that moving forward, that they were really going to have to rely on building franchises. This is just the way the entire market was going. It was becoming harder and harder for just original product to stand out on its own without a good license or without a good franchise behind it, and that the company was really going to need to pivot more in that direction. Alan Miller and Bob Whitehead were not entirely enamored with moving in this way. Combined with that, Alan Miller, as we said last time, has always been the more business-focused guy of all of the original Activision crowd, and now Whitehead and Miller at Accolade. He's getting to the point where he feels like he has enough capability and experience now that he can probably run a company himself. In 1991, they actually forced out Alan Epstein, just like they forced out for Xena. I say forced out. They're both on the board. They both have the right to put these kind of motions before the board. They're not doing anything underhanded. But for the second time, disagreements on the future of management of the company have led Miller and Whitehead to ask a president of the company to leave. First, it was Tom Frazina in 1987. Now it's Alan Epstein in 1991. This time, Alan Miller takes over the running of the company himself. Bob Whitehead very briefly comes back because Miller had been running product development, and with Miller stepping into the president and CEO role, they needed someone to run development. So Bob Whitehead actually makes a return in 91, stays for about another year just to kind of make sure that product development stays on track. But then in around 92 or 93, he leaves the company for good. At some point there, I think he even leaves the board this time, though I'm not exactly sure where. Leaving Alan Miller as the only founder left, though, as we'll soon see, that would not last long either. We've had this disastrous court situation where they basically won all of their motions on this injunction, but were still caught in a situation where they couldn't get affirmative relief and the case was going to go on for God knows how long. And during that time, they would be unable to sell any of their games. So they're finally forced to settle in 1993 under Alan Miller's watch. They're losing money. PC game development is not necessarily going to save them, and their most successful series, the Test Drive series, has basically gone dormant, not because the series is no longer successful, but because they lost the developer behind it. Now, Accolade still has the rights to the series, but a series like that, you can't just immediately turn over to anybody and expect to keep the series moving forward. The Test Drive series basically goes dormant for a time. For the first time ever, the company is going to have to take some outside money. It cannot continue in this situation. They talk to Prudential Equity and start doing some deals with them to try to get a little financing into the company. Meanwhile, kind of all of their hopes moving forward here in 1993 are all resting on the shoulders of a little bobcat by the name of Bubsy. So here we are, people. The moment that any of our listeners from the Video Game History Foundation or Gaming Alexandria Discords have been waiting for years and years and years and years. They Create Worlds now has to talk about Bubsy.
Really?
So, Bubsy and Claws Encounters of the Furred Kind, released in 1993, is a pretty typical mascot-driven platform game. Though the source of the game is rather surprising because it came from the mind of Michael Berlin, known for his adventure games. And particularly his text-based adventure games back in the days of Infocom. He was brought in, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, to Accolade to do some adventure games as Accolade tried to unsuccessfully penetrate that portion of the computer game market. He was actually starting to get kind of sick of doing adventure games and wasn't sure that he really wanted to do those anymore. And then in 1991, he witnessed Sonic the Hedgehog on the Sega Genesis. He's a game player himself. He devoured Sonic the Hedgehog. He loved Sonic the Hedgehog, and he decided, I'm going to make a game like Sonic the Hedgehog. He resolved to make himself a platformer. He worked with a producer at Accolade named John Skeel to come up with the basic concept. They decided on the Bobcat character. They knew they needed something like Mario's coins or Sonic's rings to collect, so they settled on balls of yarn, because cats and balls of yarn. Balls of yarn naturally led to the enemies of the game, the Woolies, keeping with the wool, yarn, etc. theme. In crafting the game itself, he says that he just basically followed what he considered to be the established conventions of the platform game genre, which is you do three or four levels where you're jumping around, avoiding enemies, killing enemies, collecting things. Every three or four levels, you fight a boss of some kind, and then you move on to the next set of levels, which will have some kind of scenery change to a different kind of environment. He wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel at all when it came to platform games, but that was kind of the deal. Why does anyone care about Bubsy today, then? It was just a fairly forgettable, somewhat mediocre platform game. It wasn't horrible, but it also wasn't brilliant. I mean, this is a guy that never made a platform game before. He ended up really making it a little too difficult. The enemies were a little too aggressive. It wasn't tuned well. The controls were a little bit twitchy, a little bit finicky, not the greatest. You know, it wasn't a great game, but it also wasn't an awful game. We're just talking about the first one here. We'll have more Bubsy coming, people. Don't you worry. The first game was just kind of there, but here's why this game kind of has taken on a life of its own. And it has nothing to do with Michael Berlin, and it has everything to do with his producing partner, John Skeel. John Skeel, before he had been a producer, had been in marketing at Electronic Arts. Marketing was kind of part of his primary skill set. He made the decision that he and Accolade would market the hell out of this thing. So they spent tons and tons of money marketing Bubsy. Their marketing basically made it seem like it was going to be a Sonic the Hedgehog killer. It was going to be the next big thing after Sonic the Hedgehog. Except the game was nothing like Sonic the Hedgehog, and it wasn't meant to be. It's a far more leisurely paced game than Sonic is. It's not a speed game like Sonic is. But the marketing campaign made it seem like Bubsy was going to be the natural successor to Sonic. Then, because of this full court marketing press that they were doing, they got the video game press on their side too. And so the game got glowing reviews in the video game press that really were not warranted under the circumstances. Again, it wasn't E.T. on the Genesis. I mean, it wasn't horrific. It wasn't a car crash. But it wasn't as good as the reviews made it out to be, and it wasn't a Sonic successor in the way that the advertising made it out to be. And it just comes down to the fact, quite frankly, that John Skeel did his job too well. He did his marketing job too well and created a disconnect between how the game was presented and the reality of the game. This led to the public taking note of that and I think remembering the game slightly differently as a result of that than they would have if it had just been another platformer in a sea of platformers that just disappeared into mediocrity. The game was successful. It sold really well. The first Bubsy was very successful. But, and this is very telling, because of the situation on the Genesis, where even after the lawsuit and after the settlement, again, we don't know all the details, but they had a little more control over their fate on the Genesis. They made money on it. They did not, according to insiders of the company, make money on the Super NES version. That just, I think, further highlights the point that I was making earlier. You know, you're asking, why didn't they go the standard licensing route like everyone else did? Which is a great question. I'm not belittling the question at all. That's an excellent question. Why didn't they? But I think this shows a little bit of that right here, because Bubsy was successful on both platforms, but it only made money on the Genesis. I think that Accolade, just being the small operation it was, when they were forced into the standard kind of licensing arrangement at that time, it made it very hard for them to compete.
I do remember playing Bubsy on the SNES.
What'd you think of it? Do you remember what you thought of it?
At the time, I thought it was like, it's an interesting platformer. I like the water mechanic, where the second you get onto the water chute, it forces you along in the direction of water travel.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that the flip up and down mechanic was interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a perfectly fine kind of middle of the road platform game.
Did I wake up in the middle of the night going, you know, I really need more Bubsy in my life? No.
Right.
Did I think instead that I really need more Dragon Quest in my life? Yes.
Exactly. I presume that you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I presume you weren't really dialed in to all the hype around the game when you bought it, right? I mean, you weren't aware of the marketing and the reviews and all of that stuff, right?
We only rented it, and I had a friend who owned a copy of it, but I never owned a copy of it. As far as anything else related to it, I think I only caught like a couple of episodes of the cartoon.
They did a pilot, but they never actually were able to do a full cartoon. That was, again, John Skeel. They tried to turn it into a multimedia property, and they failed. So there was only a pilot.
So I guess I saw the cartoon at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Now, obviously, we can't extrapolate an entire population based on one little Jeffrey's experience, but I think that's very telling that you were like, yeah, this game was fine. You weren't expecting it to be anything other than what it was, if that makes sense.
Right. I just thought, platformer, fun, a little bit of running, get the yarn thing. Okay, great, whatever. Didn't even really register, especially at the time, that, hey, they're trying to do a Sonic thing.
Right. Well, because they weren't. Gameplay-wise, they weren't trying to do a Sonic thing. The problem is the marketing made it seem like they were trying to do a Sonic thing. That's where the disconnect was. I think that's very telling. And then, of course, its reputation was hurt the next year. They released a Bubsy 2 and Bubsy and Fractured Furry Tales, and these games were both much worse than the original. They were not done by Michael Berlin. They were done by other people in Accolade, and I mean, Michael Berlin didn't have a great grasp on platform game design, but the people who followed him had even less of a grasp. So that also hurt the reputation retroactively, as the second and third games were so terrible. Bubsy did well, but it wasn't enough to save them. It wasn't enough to reverse all of the problems that they'd experienced in this period between kind of 1990 and 1993. So as I said, in 1993, their revenues were $45 million, which were pretty good for a closely held company that didn't really have anything going on console. But they lost several hundred thousand dollars. They were having to turn to Prudential Equity to help prop them up and keep them in business. And in 1994, Prudential said, we'll help continue to finance you, but we're going to need some new leadership at the company. In May, late April or early May, 1994, Alan Miller steps aside as CEO, position he's just held for a couple of years, stays as chairman, and a new chief executive officer is brought in by the name of Peter Harris. Peter Harris was a legend in the retail industry, because he is the man who made FAO Schwartz FAO Schwartz. He didn't found the company, but he's the one that made it the destination in high-end boutique toy stores. He had a lot of retail experience and had been running a department store chain when in 1984 he went in with a partner, a financier from Philadelphia named Peter Morse, to acquire the FAO Schwartz chain, which was struggling. It was on the brink of failing. He completely changed their strategy. Rather than making them kind of a typical sell the cheap toys for as cheap as possible, low margin toy store, he decided to change FAO Schwartz into a toy shopping experience. He didn't worry about the price. He started adding more expensive toys, toys above the $20 range that a lot of toy stores wouldn't carry. He started approaching real boutique toy companies, international toy companies, a lot of these companies that didn't really have strong distribution in toy stores, that were more niche products, and stocked the shelves of FAO Schwartz with the products of these companies. He offered free gift wrapping he offered personal shopping services for parents that couldn't keep up with what the latest craze was that their kids wanted. You could, for a premium, have the store do the shopping for you, essentially. He did all of these things to make shopping easier for parents, though for a price, to provide toys, again, often more expensive, that you couldn't find anywhere else. And he turned his flagship location in New York City into a wonderland full of incredible displays, many of them interactive. I presume you are familiar with the classic Tom Hanks movie, Big, Jeffrey.
I am. I believe this even came up in our 1985 Nintendo episode where he's dancing on the keyboard in FAO Schwartz.
Exactly. The famous scene. Now, obviously, the toy store in the movie was a fictional toy store, but it was shot in the flagship New York location of FAO Schwartz. That keyboard was really there. It wasn't just set up for the movie. He turned FAO Schwartz into a high-end boutique toy retailer that became wildly successful. A company with sales of $17 million in 1984 had sales by 1990 of $60 million, a fourfold increase in sales in just 6 years. That same year, Harris sold FAO Schwartz to a Dutch retail conglomerate. But he continued to stay on for another 2 years, and he finally left in 1992 because he wanted to move to the Bay Area. I'm not sure if he was from the Bay Area originally or had just been there for a long time, but he really didn't want to raise his kids in Manhattan anymore. He wanted to raise his kids in California. He walked away from the whole thing to go back to California and then was kind of idly looking for other opportunities and then hit upon this Accolade thing 2 years later. I don't know the exact details about how Harris got involved. I haven't talked to him. I assume Prudential was probably the ones that went to him. Of course, he was a legendary turnaround artist because he had turned around FAO Schwartz. He was somebody that understood toys. Now, he didn't understand video games necessarily, but he understood toys. He understood children's entertainment. He was a high-profile name that would help attract other investors into the company as well. I think that's why he was chosen. He was probably chosen by Prudential. He came on in May 1994 to be the new CEO. He restructured the company. He went through some layoffs, that kind of thing. Alan Miller, don't know exactly why, except that I know he wasn't forced out, because I've talked to people who were there at the time. He wasn't forced out. Alan Miller did decide that he didn't want to be a part of this anymore and actually leaves not too long after Peter Harris arrives to found a company called Click Health dedicated to medical technology. So Peter Harris takes on the chairman role as well. Of course, Whitehead was already gone, so that was the end of the founder participation when Alan Miller left in 1994. He did help attract additional investment in addition to Prudential's investment. He helps get Warner Music Group to also invest in the company in return for getting the distribution of Accolade products. Warner Music, even though it's in the music business, they have a huge distribution arm. We've talked about that sometimes in the context of our Atari episodes when Warner Music kept trying to take over Atari distribution and was never given the opportunity to do so. He helps close around $30 million total of investment, primarily from Prudential and Warner Music. Then he does quickly realize that this is not the business for him. He really doesn't understand the video game business. He doesn't really understand being at a video game development and publishing company. He is a toy retail guy. That's what he understands. He very quickly backs away and decides that he doesn't really want to be a part of this. In his place, he promotes a guy that he brought with him when he came in to restructure by the name of Jim Barnett. Jim Barnett is somebody I actually have talked to. I've interviewed him. Barnett, again, had no experience in the video game business, but he did have experience in the entertainment business. He had a business degree and a law degree from Stanford, so he's a very savvy guy. His family had been involved in the entertainment business. He had gone and worked for Universal and had a lot of experience in the movie business. He moved from there into private equity very briefly, decided that he really preferred running a company, so he moved back out of that, ended up becoming president of a company called the Spectrum Group. Peter Harris was actually on his board at that company and was really impressed with him, and also understood that he had a background both in entertainment and in equity, which were both things that were going to be very valuable in the Accolade turnaround. So he asked Barnett to come with him to Accolade and help him turn the company around. So that's what Barnett did when Peter Harris came in 1994. He joined him. He got promoted to president at the beginning of 1995. And then when Harris decided to get out entirely later in the year, he took over as the CEO of the company as well. So it was really Jim Barnett's job to bring this company back. Knowing that he didn't have any experience in the video game business, he brought in an industry veteran to help him do that by the name of Stan Roach. Stan Roach, who just recently passed away at the time of this recording, is also someone I have interviewed, so I have insights from both Barnett and Roach from this time period. Stan Roach started his career at Procter & Gamble as a product manager. He was hired into Electronic Arts very early to bring some of that product management sensibility from Procter & Gamble into Electronic Arts. He held a product management and marketing role at Electronic Arts until about 1988. And then after a reorganization at the company in which he didn't get the job position he wanted, he left for Activision/Mediagenic, where he became VP of Sales and Marketing. Stayed there through to about the time of the bankruptcy and the Kotick buyout. Left the video game industry for a time to work for another technology company, and then had recently come back in at Sony Electronic Publishing and Sony ImageSoft, and was briefly the head of Sony ImageSoft on a consulting basis. Decided not to take that job full-time because of some of the difficulties in the company structure at that time with a lot of the management in New York, but him having to run it in California, and decided ultimately not to stay on full-time, though helped hire his successor, Kelly Flock, who he had also mentored at Electronic Arts, and then joined Accolade in a role that was, even though this wasn't his title, was basically the chief operating officer of the company. But he operated on what they liked to internally call the VP of SLIMO, which was an acronym for Sales, Licensing, International, Marketing, and Operations. As you can see, he ran basically every function of the company outside of finance was his area. That's because he had experience in all of those different roles at Electronic Arts and Activision, etc. Barnett was the CEO, but he was really leaning heavily on Stan Roach to do the day-to-day of the company. Funnily enough, they decided that the way that they had to turn the company around was basically the exact same thing that Alan Epstein was saying that they should be doing back in the early 90s that got him partially responsible for getting him kicked out of the company. That is that in this environment in the mid-90s where development costs are rising and where the market is very crowded and it's hard to get retail shelf space, all of these challenges that I'm sure we've talked about in one episode or another, when talking about some of the companies like Broderbund or Sierra that fell apart in the 1990s. With all of these pressures, they decided that the only way really going forward is they had to be franchise focused. They had to build two or three really solid franchises that could serve as the basis for moving the company forward. At this time, even though we talked about all of these evergreen franchises that they had back in the 80s, they really only had one franchise left at this point that had managed to retain its evergreen status through this entire time. That's the Hardball franchise. The Hardball baseball games were still doing really well. Everything else was either dormant or in decline. So they looked at the franchises that they had, and they decided that the only way really forward was to resurrect what had once been their flagship franchise back in the old Distinctive Software days. And that, of course, is Test Drive. So that is where they put the majority of their focus in the 95-96 time period, was bringing back the Test Drive series. Stan Roach went over to England and found a relatively new developer staffed by industry veterans called Pitbull and enlisted them to create Test Drive 4, new Test Drive game. He also went to Elite Systems, which we did an episode on, and contracted them to do a spin-off game, Test Drive Off-Road, which instead of being racing luxury cars along the highway, was all about driving big, sturdy SUVs, trucks, Hummers, those kind of vehicles in off-road conditions. Kind of two different slices of the traditional test drive gameplay. He also went out and worked magic doing a bunch of licensing to get some music tracks for the games, popular music, that kind of stuff, and worked tirelessly to get the test drive series going again. That was the primary focus. At the same time, and they were focusing primarily on console with that. At the same time, they were also looking to resurrect and even create some new franchises on computer platforms, on PC platforms as well. So they started a new franchise, a turn-based strategy franchise called Deadlock, and they also resurrected the Star Control franchise, which after Star Control 2 had lain dormant for a few years. Deadlock was a decent success on computer platforms. It sold over 100,000 units. Star Control 3 was also a decent, okay hit on computer platforms, also topping that 100,000 unit mark. It's remembered somewhat controversially today because it was not created by Toys for Bob. Basically, according to Ritchie and Ford, Accolade did try to enlist them to create Star Control 3, but offered them the exact same budget that they had had on Star Control 2, which was not going to cut it. It was not going to be enough money to create a better version of the game. Development costs have gone up, etc. So they declined to do the job. So instead, Accolade approached Legend Entertainment, Bob Bates' company that was primarily known for adventure games, funnily enough, but were huge Star Control fans. Legend Entertainment built Star Control 3. It's similar in a lot of ways to the second game, but instead of having to gather resources, which was seen by some as tedious, it's a game where you had to manage colonies across the galaxy, but was still focused primarily, just as the first two games were, on that combat, that one-on-one combat system based on Space War with all of these fascinating aliens and different ships with different capabilities. The gameplay was pretty solid. I think there was some disappointment amongst hardcore fans about the story of the game, and that disappointment was compounded by the fact that it was not Toys for Bob doing it. It was another company. There was nothing malicious about Legend doing it, and Legend were great fans, and they did everything in their power to maintain an excellent stewardship of the game. If you're already a little leery about the direction the story's taken, then the fact that it's not the original developers doing it adds another level of disillusionment. Star Control 3 did fine. It sold decently well, but today it's just not remembered very fondly by the Star Control faithful, despite all of that. Those two games both did okay, but their sales probably topped out at, we don't have final sales figures. I know from press releases they both sold 100,000 units within 60 days. With the hits-driven nature of the business in this time period, they probably didn't sell that many more after that, but certainly they had to have sold some. So for the sake of argument, let's say they topped out at 200,000 units or something like that. I mean, that's estimate, but it's reasonable. The new Test Drive games, Test Drive 4 and Test Drive Off-Road, Test Drive 4 sold 800,000 plus units. This is a console game. Off-Road sold 500,000 plus units. Again, also a console game. So at that point, the powers that be at Accolade, Barnett, and Roach and all of them decided that they really needed to focus on console, and they really needed to just kind of focus on the hardball and the test drive franchises. Even though a game like Deadlock or Star Control 3 was moderately successful, they were not successful enough compared to the console product to keep going.
100,000 units isn't big enough anymore.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, in the same period of time, they tried to revive Jack Nicklaus Golf as well. They released a new Jack Nicklaus game. It got good critical reviews. It didn't really sell all that well. And they actually sold that franchise off entirely. In 1998, they sell off the Jack Nicklaus franchise to Activision. Again, this is still a relatively small company in a relatively precarious position, even after their new financing, so they can only afford to spread the money around so far, and so they decide to really concentrate the money in the places where it seems it's going to be do the most good. Now, that doesn't mean they don't also make other games, too, because they do, but they really start to hone in on Test Drive and spinoffs of Test Drive, and also keeping that hardball license going as well.
So you're saying that they couldn't compete with Lee Corvallo's putting challenge, which all the kids needed to play.
That's right. Bonus points if you get that reference, as always. Then you have to ask, well, what about that other franchise? What franchise have I failed to mention, Jeffrey, that we know the listeners want to hear a little more about?
Bubsy.
That's right. Because, of course, they did also try during this time period to extend the Bubsy franchise. Because the first game had been very successful. The two sequels had not been. But the first one was very successful. And again, the entire strategy was try to reinvigorate their franchises. In fact, it's kind of funny. I have an article from the Wall Street Journal in June 1994. I will quote the article that says, Mr. Harris says he plans to gain more value from Accolade's current products and then orchestrate its move into new technologies. He and Mr. Downer, also an Accolade board member, vow not to repeat the Bubsy Bobcat fiasco.
Oh, dear.
It's the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, that's not encouraging.
Because the second and third games had been so horribly received, and even the first game, there were issues, even though it was on the whole a success. They really did, obviously it wasn't Harris anymore, it was Barnett and Roach, but they really did try to avoid some of the fiasco of those later games. They actually go back to Michael Berlin, because remember, the first game had been decently successful. So they actually went back to creator Michael Berlin, who by this time had formed a partnership with Mark Blank, fellow Infocom alum. They had done some software on the Apple Newton, remember that little thing? But made enough money, despite the utter failure of that platform, to found a new game development company, Eidetic. So they had a development company. So they went to Berlin and Eidetic and said, can you make a next generation Bubsy game for us? Of course, Berlin said, sure, we'll do that. So they prepared to do Bubsy on the PlayStation and move the franchise into 3D.
With, I presume, Bubsy 3D.
What could possibly go wrong?
Absolutely nothing. 3D is fantastic and way of the future.
Now we have to preface what we're going to say about Bubsy 3D, which is bad. I mean, let's not sugarcoat that. It's bad. But we have to preface our discussion of Bubsy 3D by remembering that it was very early as a 3D game on console. Nobody really knew what a 3D platform game was yet at that time. According to one of the people that worked on the project that did an interview with Retro Gamer, they did not have much of a frame of reference for what a 3D platform game could look like, but they did have one, a relatively obscure Japanese PlayStation game that was released worldwide in 1995 called Jumping Flash. Jumping Flash is not a particularly remarkable game, but the people at Eidetic decided to use this as the base for what they could improve on in their own game. Jumping Flash was first person, getting around presumably some of the problems of cameras and all of that. So since Jumping Flash was first person, they decided that their game would be third person. Jumping Flash had very small levels. So the Bubsy 3D people decided that they would have huge levels. Jumping Flash did not use high-resolution polygons. In fact, most PlayStation games did not use high-resolution polygons. So they decided that their game would have high-resolution polygons. This last thing, more than anything else, was their most disastrous mistake. Because it turns out there was a reason that PlayStation games did not use the highest resolution mode for polygons. That is, ate up all the system memory, and there was no room left for textures.
What textures? We don't need textures. Textures aren't good. We don't even need lighting effects. Lighting effects doesn't even make a video game look good. Ambient occlusion, that's occluding my ability to see the game.
They did use shaded polygons in Bubsy 3D, but yeah, in order to do the high resolution mode, which they thought based on the few games that had been released at the time they were in development here, This is before all the big heavy hitters. This is before Tomb Raider. This is before Mario 64. This is before Crash Bandicoot. This is before all of them. They thought that going this high-resolution route would make their game stand out technologically from the competition that hadn't gone that direction, and they just had no guide to tell them that this was a horrible idea. So in order to make use of that high-resolution mode, it made them do two things. First of all, like I said, they couldn't use textured polygons. But the other thing is that they had to really, in order to emphasize the characters like Bubsy in high-resolution, they had to do the background very sparsely. The background was very sparse. So they decided to do these big worlds, big open worlds, which was also in hindsight a mistake. So they basically had these giant spaces filled with nothing interesting whatsoever. Then on top of that, you of course have the original PlayStation problem at launch, which is that they didn't have the clever idea to do analog sticks like the Nintendo 64 did. There's no DualShock controller at the launch of the PlayStation. You basically have tank controls, which is about the best you can do in 3D on a standard PlayStation controller, to try to navigate this huge, empty, platforming worlds.
You're trying to make precise jumps to small platforms, leaving your own platform, and you have no clue what is going on.
Exactly, and it's all just bland and ugly to look at. And then, to add insult to injury, when they're getting really near to their release date, Mario 64 is unveiled to the world. Let's just say Miyamoto and company did a slightly better job of making the transition to 3D than the good folks at Eidetic did with Bubsy. On top of that, Crash Bandicoot is coming along. Very shortly. Also at the end of 1996, which is not open world like Bubsy and Mario, but, as we discussed in our Naughty Dog episodes, took the very sensible route of having fixed levels that they could fill with all sorts of objects, textured objects, etc., to create a far better game experience considering the constraints of the PlayStation.
Let's be fair here. They cheated. They didn't even use the APIs.
No, I know they cheated, but that's even beside the point, because the key for the purposes of comparisons with Bubsy is not so much that they cheated, which, yes, that did help them do things better, but it provided a different way forward. Literally, because the whole game is just running forward. The big open world concept didn't really work on the PlayStation at this time. It was much better to have a platform game that had narrow constraints in the manner that Crash Bandicoot did. So you had Crash Bandicoot on one side, cheating and all, with much better textured polygons, much better stages, and much more focused gameplay. Then on the other side, you had Super Mario 64, which shows what big, truly open world stages can be in terms of level of interest and gameplay, and of course had the analog stick to make controlling so much better. Coming out at the same time as these two landmark 3D games was not going to do any other game any favor. But it most especially did not do Bubsy 3D any favors, which looked terrible and played terrible compared to both of these games. If it had come out in 1995 in that state, it wouldn't have been any better of a game. It still would have been a bad game. But I don't think it would have been as infamous. Because it was all so new, people were still trying to figure out what it meant to do a 3D platform game. I think it would have been okay to be a failed experiment in 1995. It was not okay to be a failed experiment on that scale in 1996 when you have Super Mario 64 and Crash Bandicoot launching, and you also have, for good measure, Tomb Raider, which is a slightly different kind of game, but is still just showing you this is what a game in a 3D space can be, and you are not it. They came at it from a place of good intention. It wasn't a rush job. It wasn't a cash-in. It was a team of people legitimately trying to push the medium forward. But just because you want to doesn't mean you necessarily know how to. And this was definitely a case of a developer's reach exceeding their grasp. Though, don't feel too bad for them, because they did learn a lot about how to do 3D by doing this. They got a 3D engine out of this. So they went directly to Sony, because they're not owned by Accolade. They were just contracted by Accolade. They went directly to Sony, said, hey, we have a 3D engine. Why don't we do a 3D game directly for you? And they were like, sure, we would really like something like that GoldenEye game that all the kids are raving about. And they went on and created Siphon Filter. So for Eidetic, there's a happy ending at the end of all of this. For Accolade, not so much, because they failed to move the Bubsy franchise forward into a new console generation. At this point, they basically just have Test Drive and Hardball. Yes, they have other games here and there that they're doing, but that's basically it. They're still paying Sega for all the stuff related to the legal case. They have some financing now. They do have some equity partners, but they don't really have any avenues to grow at this point. The industry is in full-fledged consolidation mode. If you don't have any means to grow, then you really have to start looking at your exit strategy. And that's exactly what Barnett starts to do. They divest themselves of Jack Nicklaus, as we said. In 1997, they also become an affiliated label of Electronic Arts. Electronic Arts takes over all of their distribution as part of that affiliated label deal. So they're kind of giving that up. Of course, they had given it to Warner before that, Warner Music, but now they're giving it to Electronic Arts. They're really looking for a way to get out of the business. Not go bankrupt or anything like that. They're still profitable, but they know that they're not going anywhere. They either need to be acquired or they're just going to slowly fade away. So that's why in 1999, they end up making the deal with Infogrames that we talked about in our Infogrames episode. Infogrames, of course, is in the midst of a massive expansion at this point. They're really trying to crack the North American market for the first time. And Accolade is an established publisher with established connections in that market. So it was a very valuable company for Infogrames just for that publishing and distribution and American know-how. They don't care about the franchises. They don't care about the developers. They don't care about the people.
They don't care about Bubsy.
Definitely don't care about Bubsy. They just really need that North American base of operations. They have one, but it's very small. This will be bigger. So in 1999, they buy Accolade. It's renamed Infogrames North America. Infocom North America exists very briefly. Jim Barnett stays on for a brief time as CEO. Then he leaves and Stan Roach stays and kind of takes over. He doesn't like become, I don't think, the CEO or president officially, but basically takes over keeping the lights on there. They finally, this is just an interesting footnote story, but in this period, they finally get rid of their Sega debt because they're actually working on a mech game called Slave Zero. It's barely a footnote in gaming history. It's not important. They're working on a mech game called Slave Zero, and Sega was so desperate for publishers on the Dreamcast that they came to Accolade and said, hey guys, I see you're working on this 3D mech game. We'd like to put that on the Dreamcast, and if you'll agree to port to the Dreamcast, we'll forgive all of your remaining obligations stemming from the court case. So they were like, sure, we'll do that. So they did finally get out from under their Sega obligation. They do release a couple of games that were in development as Infogrames North America, so Test Drive 6. I know we skipped one in there. There was obviously also a 5, but Test Drive 6 and the second Test Drive off-road game, which is called Test Drive 4x4, both come out under this Infogrames North American label. They were already under development at Accolade. But then in 2000, Infogrames gets the unexpected opportunity to purchase GT Interactive, which again, we also talk about in our Infogrames episode. GT Interactive is in the big time of North American publishers. I imagine that if they had realized that a company like GT that was many times bigger than Infogrames was ever something that they could possibly dream of buying, they probably would have never even bothered buying Accolade. Once they had GT Interactive, which they renamed Infogrames Incorporated, they really didn't have a need anymore for Accolade / Infogrames North America. So in 2000, they merged Infogrames North America into Infogrames Incorporated, or to put it another way, merged the former Accolade into the former GT Interactive. So that was the total and final end of Accolade in any way, shape, or form, even as a successor company under another publisher. That was the end. I mean, the New York people at that point just basically, you know, took over the running of everything. The GT Interactive people became the Infogrames North American branch people. Accolade was basically no more. So a rather ignominious end. It's kind of funny that they seem to be doing so well when we left them off in part one, circa 1990. Then just within a decade, they completely fell apart. But it's really indicative of something that we've talked about in many episodes when we've covered the 90s, which is just the industry changed so much in the 90s. The stakes got so much higher. The development costs got higher. The marketing costs got higher. The shelf space competition was fiercer. And consolidation was the order of the day. And you either got yourself a couple of really major hits and used that as a way to be an acquirer of other companies, or you just failed to do much and you joined the ranks of the acquirees and vanished from the business, in large part because of the situation with the court case, but also due to other challenges, some of which we went over in this episode. Accolade could never quite get together the hit franchises they needed to grow big enough to become an acquirer, so had to settle for becoming just another casualty in the video game consolidation wars of the 1990s.
It just really seems like they shot themselves in their foot a few times throughout what was going on in the 90s there.
They did. I think they, like I said, I think they felt trapped. I think they felt they were kind of in a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation. So, I mean, you have to respect them for rolling the dice. I mean, they didn't just decide, well, this is hopeless, let's give up. They did try. And I can respect them for that, even if some of the gambles they took most assuredly did not pay off.
I don't think they get any kind of award now since they're gone.
No further accolades for Accolade, that's for sure.
Yeah, no accolades for Accolades. That should have been the episode. It's like Accolade for Accolades and no accolades for Accolades. Well, I can't change it now, so I'm sorry.
What might have been, just like Accolade, just like the story of Accolade, what might have been
there you go.
If different choices were made, Jeffrey.
What might have been. I know, all these different choices we could have made. So what's going to be our next topic where we might explore success, failure, sadness, greatness, acquisitions, and selling?
We might do all of those things, except set it in the context of the swinging 1970s, which we've done very little coverage of recently. I think it's time to go talk about a little coin-op company called Ramtech. It's not very well known today. It's pretty obscure. But for a very brief period in the middle of the 1970s, it was one of the most important coin-operated video game companies, only to very quickly kind of fade away and decide to get out of the business. So it's a roller coaster ride, and it's a pretty quick roller coaster ride because they entered the business in 1973, right at the beginning, and they were out of it by 1980s. Something we can actually do in one episode, an interesting story, and one that isn't as well known as some of the other companies we talk about, and a return to the 70s, which I think we're overdue for at this point. So yeah, let's do some Ramtech next.
All right. I know we've talked about Ramtech a little bit in some of our arcade stuff in the past and some of the video game stuff.
Yep.
Got to keep finishing off these little loose ends from the They Create Worlds lore here.
From the TCWCU, the They Create Worlds cinematic universe.
This is an audio podcast. What cinematics is there?
Exactly.
Well, I'll let you kids ponder that one while I wonder what Alex really is getting at. Next time on They Create Worlds. Check out our show notes at podcast.theycreateworlds.com, where we have linked to some of the things that we discuss in this and other episodes. You can check out Alex's video game history blog at videogamehistorian.wordpress.com. Alex's book, They Create Worlds, The Story of the People and Companies That Shaped the Video Game Industry, Volume 1, can now be ordered through CRC Press and at major online retailers. Email us at feedback@theycreateworlds.com. Please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/theycreateworlds. You can also help by getting the word out by leaving a review on your favorite podcasting service. We now have the podcast available on YouTube. Like and subscribe. Intro music is Airplane Mode by Josh Woodward. Found at joshwoodward.com/song/airplane mode. Used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Outro music is Bacterial Love by Roller Music. Found at freemusicarchive.org. Used under a Creative Commons Attribution License.